This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Scenes of chaos in Lebanon's capital today. Heavy shooting broke out in the streets of Beirut, leaving residents scrambling.
I quickly packed one suitcase and then immediately left Beirut to go up to the mountains.
Worried about what comes next. In Puerto Rico, a state of emergency for a broken electrical grid. Those problems there are not new.
You know, as they say, what starts crooked usually ends crooked.
I'm Marco Werman. Plus, how much time do you give a book that is not rocking your world? One author says 20 pages, then throw it, literally, at the wall. And we remember Paddy Maloney and his magical penny whistle. That's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us. Violence in the streets of Beirut today, scenes reminiscent of Lebanon's civil war in the 1980s. Today, armed supporters of Hezbollah and the Amal political party demonstrated in a Beirut neighborhood. They were demanding the resignation of a judge overseeing the investigation of the blast that destroyed the port and large parts of the city in August of last year. Then, out of nowhere, gunfire erupted. At least six people were killed. Beirut resident Jumana Zabena witnessed the scene.
So we started hearing like heavy shootings, nonstop heavy shootings. So I immediately took the stairs down to go to the school, and I saw all the parents in the streets, lots of traffic, people panicking, women and men crying because they wanted to reach their kids, and the shooting continued.
Jumana says she picked up her daughters at school to walk them home.
So as soon as we reached home, I put my kids in the corridor in between the kitchen and the toilet. That seemed to me the safest spot in the house. And then quickly packed one suitcase and then immediately left Beirut to go up to the mountains.
A precaution in case of fighting in Beirut continues. With us now to discuss this latest violence is Randa Slim. She's a senior fellow with the Middle East Institute in Washington. What is your reaction to what happened today in Beirut, Randa?
Well, I think partly violence was expected after the demonstration has been called by Hezbollah and Amal. And this is exactly what happened. Now, I don't think any of the parties in Lebanon, including Hezbollah and Amal, want this violence to escalate even more than it is today. I'm hoping that this will be the end, at least, of this cycle of violence.
So this was rooted in the judge who was investigating the port blast in 2020. The armed supporters of Shiite political groups, Hezbollah and Amal, were marching through a Christian area at the time of the shooting. What does that tell us? Is there a sectarian aspect to today's violence?
I do not want to go and say sectarian because also part of the allies of Hezbollah and Amal are Christian. And so it's not really Christian versus Muslims. It's not Shia versus Sunni. It's and we have to say that all of the political parties, including the Christian party that is accused today of shooting at the protesters, the Lebanese forces, all of the parties have been complicit in opposing this investigation and in trying to force the judge, Judge Bitar, to resign.
So let's talk about this investigating judge. Why are Lebanon's Shiite political parties and armed groups adamant about removing the judge in the Beirut blast investigation?
Well, it is, again, not only the Shiite who are adamant at removing him. This is the second judge. The first judge was removed, again, after pressure from representative of all the parties, Sunni, Shia, Christians. However, this time, Hezbollah have taken the lead in the opposition, and in this case, in calling for the demonstration, although none of their ministers and none of their parliamentarians have been called by the judge to be questioned. Until now, nobody has been accused. All this judge has done is summon some of the former ministers of Amal and the former minister of Merada, an ally of Hezbollah and Amal, for questioning.
Is there concern among these groups that if their witnesses go before the judge, something will be discovered about them?
You know, there is concern that this is a politicized investigation, that they do not trust that this is not going to be biased against them. And the fact that it's mostly the allies of Hezbollah right now who have been called for questioning, Hezbollah is claiming this is evidence that this is going to be a biased investigation and not an impartial investigation. But all the parties do not want the investigation to succeed. All the parties do not want to basically see evidence that the investigation will uncover come to surface. And they have an interest in killing this investigation as quickly as possible.
Evidence of what? Of deep corruption?
Evidence of deep corruption, evidence of neglect, evidence of who brought the ammonium nitrate in big amounts to the port, who gave the order to keep them stored, which minister approved it, which party like Hezbollah was, you know, involved in this. These are all questions that all these parties, and particularly Hezbollah, are afraid to find answers to.
So the violence today in Beirut, do you see it as a distraction to the whole investigation or even an attempt to kind of throw the investigation off?
Exactly. And I think this is now where we are. It's no longer, you know, the debate now in Lebanon is no longer about the investigation, is about how to quell this violence. And if the price is going to be to force the judge to resign, and this will be the second judge to resign or to be moved out of the case, I think all the parties will go for it as well. And then the investigation will come to a stop.
That's not going to make a lot of people in Lebanon very happy, though.
It's not going to make the families of the victims who died in the blast happy. It's not going to make a lot of people in Lebanon who really are seeing through this investigation as the beginning to putting an end to cycles of impunity that have, you know, that have plagued political life in Lebanon and holding, you know, all these officials, all of them from all of the parties accountable.
Randa Slim is a senior fellow with the Middle East Institute in Washington. Randa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Condolences from around the world are pouring in for Kenyan long-distance runner Agnes Tirop. She was found dead at her home in Iten, a well-known training town for Kenya's top runners. This evening, local time, police announced the arrest of Tirop's husband as a suspect. That's according to the French news agency AFP. The world's Halima Gikandi has more from Nairobi.
Agnes Tirop was considered a running star on the rise. At only 25 years old, she had already won numerous medals. She was part of Kenya's 2020 Olympic team, and last month, she set a new world record in the women's 10,000-meter race. Here's what she said right after her win. She panted with a smile draped under Kenya's flag.
Yeah, I'm happy for being a world record holder. I'm so happy for it.
We're happy for you. You're smiling, the sun is shining, and we've seen a new world record. Ladies and gentlemen, world record holder, Agnes Tirop.
The Kenyan and international sports community was shocked then to hear that Tirop was dead. She was found in her home yesterday. Local police commander Tom McCory described a grisly scene. He said it looked like Tirop had been stabbed. Her husband is a prime suspect. It's now emerging that they were allegedly having marital problems. That's news to Barnaba Courier. He was the general team manager for Kenya's Olympic team and worked closely with Agnes Tirop. He told me that he had spoken with her on Monday.
And she was really happy, jovial. I didn't detect any problems at all. It's only that yesterday is when I heard about her demise, and it really shocked me. Even up to now, I'm really shocked because this is one of the best athletes that we were going to depend on.
Many in Kenya's sports community are viewing Tirop's death as a wake-up call about the challenges facing the country's top athletes. Jack Tuwei is the president of Athletics Kenya Federation. He notes that a number of Kenyan athletes have died prematurely due to suicide, family disputes, alcoholism, and other life problems.
A number of athletes are suffering immensely in their personal spaces, but have chosen not to seek help for fear of stigma by society.
He said the Federation is planning to take more steps to support Kenya's athletes, including offering mental health seminars. Tuwei also announced that all sports events for the next 2 weeks will be canceled countrywide out of respect for the death of Agnes Tirop. For The World, I'm Halima Kakandi in Nairobi.
Take a drive through Vermont this time of year. The rolling hills and grazing cows are straight out of a postcard. Less visible is who is powering those dairy farms, an army of migrant farm workers, many of whom are undocumented. To help protect this vital industry, Vermont now prevents state and local police from turning over undocumented people to federal immigration officials. But as Vermont Public Radio's Peter Hirschfeld reports, body camera footage from a recent traffic stop in Vermont suggests that some officers are disregarding the policy.
Can I see your license, registration, insurance?
It's a little after 8:30 in the morning on a partly cloudy day in Newport, yes. Vermont, on June 29th, 2021. Sergeant Richard Wells with the Orleans County Sheriff's Department stops Lorenzo Ulloa Valenzuela for speeding. Normally, getting popped for a minor traffic violation is hardly a life-altering event. For Valenzuela, though, the stakes are raised when Sergeant Wells goes back to his car and radios dispatch.
Orleans 401. Can you make a 21 over to Border Patrol and see if they have anybody in the area who can translate for me.
Wells soon returns to Valenzuela's vehicle to update him on the situation.
Don't be alarmed. I have Border Patrol coming here to translate for me.
It's clear on the video that Valenzuela, who's been working without documentation at a nearby dairy farm for 3 years, is alarmed by Wells' mention of Border Patrol. His face suddenly drops and he draws his left hand over his mouth. Valenzuela doesn't speak much English, but he activates a translation app on his phone so he can communicate to the officer that there's no need for Border Patrol.
Yo tengo otra persona que puede traducir.
I have another person.
As the interaction proceeds, though, it becomes clear that translation services aren't the only reason Sergeant Wells is enlisting U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Here he is again speaking to a dispatcher.
But I believe this person is still probably illegal here, so they can... Still 76, and I'll chat with them.
Still 76 is code that means Border Protection should stay en route to the scene, presumably so they can detain Valenzuela for being in the country without permission.
Well, I think we've seen time and time again that local law enforcement, Vermont law enforcement, will reach out to Border Patrol and ICE in a variety of circumstances when the state has made a clear policy that that is not what Vermont wants its officers to be doing.
That's Jay Diaz, general counsel at the Vermont chapter of the ACLU. He's underscoring the reality for many migrant farm workers here, like Olga. She's lived in Vermont for 9 years. We're using her first name only because of her undocumented status.
Yo voy a responder un poco a esto. La verdad es mucha importancia.
Olga says that the police officer's body cam footage goes against the collaboration between the police and immigration officials that many farm workers here have fought against. Seeing this video, she says, makes her feel like that struggle has been in vain. Olga belongs to an organization called Migrant Justice, which works to improve protections for migrant farm workers in Vermont. And stops like the one in Newport are why Migrant Justice is asking the state to update the fair and impartial policing policy.
Because essentially what we have here is a systemic failure.
Will Lambeck is also with Migrant Justice and says the current fair and impartial policing policy contains giant loopholes that give police a way to adhere to the letter of the policy but violate its intent.
The carve-outs are so broad and so poorly defined that time and time again we've seen Vermont law enforcement agents involve immigration in a traffic stop and then after the fact use these categories to justify that assault.
So Migrant Justice wants the state to adopt a policy that better protects undocumented communities. Lambeck says 8 law enforcement agencies in Vermont have already adopted that more stringent language on their own. Justin Stedman is a Vermont law enforcement officer who was appointed to serve on an independent council that reviews proposed changes to the fair and impartial policing policy. He agrees that Vermont's policy should be as protective as possible for undocumented residents.
Let's be honest. If migrants are afraid of the police, you know, they're the most likely to be taken advantage of because people are, well, they're not going to go to the cops. So, they, you know, it puts people who are at extreme risk and even more at more of a risk if they don't feel comfortable coming to law enforcement.
But Stedman says federal law prohibits states from restricting certain communication between state and federal authorities, and the proposed language for migrant justice, he says, likely conflicts with federal law. Lorenzo Ulloa Valenzuela didn't end up coming into contact with Border Protection on that morning of June 29th, but immigrant advocates here say that Valenzuela was simply fortunate enough to depart the scene before immigration authorities had time to arrive. And they worry the next farm worker stopped by police won't be so lucky. For The World News, I'm Peter Hirschfeld in Montpelier, Vermont.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. If President Biden gets his wish, the American coastline is going to look pretty different by the end of the decade. The administration laid out its plans yesterday to develop large-scale offshore wind projects along almost the entire U.S. coastline as part of the president's push to drastically cut fossil fuel emissions. The fledgling U.S. offshore wind industry is going to need a lot of know-how. That's where Alan Loudon comes in. He's a 20-year veteran of offshore wind projects, mostly in the U.K. He's now in Fall River, Massachusetts, at the National Offshore Wind Institute. Alan, what was the institute created to do?
So it's there to train the next generation, or the first generation, actually, for the U.S., of offshore wind workers. It's also there to stimulate a feeling of innovation and entrepreneurship to create the jobs which the U.S. industry is going to need in abundance.
And when the U.K. ramped up its offshore wind projects, how fast was the country able to get a bunch of new workers trained and on the job?
A lot of the opportunity is in the retraining or reskilling or upskilling of existing workers who are used to working on assets, power stations. You know, there could be water treatment plant, nuclear power, aerospace, automotive. So there's huge opportunities for individuals coming into this industry to use their core skills, but to reorient them towards the offshore wind space. And it did it. I mean, the UK is continuing to do it.
There must be a lot of differences, though, when a worker in natural gas, for example, transitions to work in offshore wind power.
It depends what you're going to do in the industry, of course. There's a huge supply chain, and you can find yourself as a financier in the industry as much as you can somebody who's actually going offshore to maintain the turbines. So it depends what the core skills are, but fundamentally, as long as you have the basic understanding of how the wind turbine operates, the basic safety training, the basic technical training, you're off to a great start.
So, Alan, you're British. I know the UK and Germany are ahead of the US on offshore wind. And the last time I flew into Copenhagen in Denmark, that was 10 years ago. It was incredible, the number of windmills in the water on the approach of the city. But that was a decade ago. How far ahead of the US are these countries today?
Well, I mean, the UK has got about 10 gigawatts of installed capacity. It's the biggest in the world at the moment, although China is rapidly coming up on our heels in the UK. So 10 gigawatts is a significant number of turbines. 1 gigawatt powers around about 500,000 homes. So 10 gigawatts is 5 million homes. So you can scale it up on that basis.
Just a few months ago, the Biden administration approved Vineyard Wind. That's the nation's first major commercial offshore wind farm in federal waters off the coast of Martha's Vineyard here in Massachusetts. Are European countries involved in that?
Yes. I mean, the two principal consortium members behind Vineyard Wind are Copenhagen Investment Partners and Avon Grid, which is a big Spanish utility, which also owns Scottish Power in the UK.
So to reach Biden's goal of 30 gigawatts, how much help will the U.S. need from countries like the U.K. or Denmark?
Well, I think the name of the game is to catalyze the industry with European assistance, because why wouldn't you? Because there's been mistakes made in Europe, which we can avoid making in the United States and will. So the U.S. is entering the offshore wind market at a very opportune stage. It's got a lot of indigenous skills in terms of the fabrication and the ocean faring industries. So I don't think it'll be too long before the U.S. supply chain starts to mature with U.S. workers, U.S. corporations, U.S. startups, U.S. small, medium enterprises.
Alan, in the U.S., the offshore wind projects that are being discussed seem to be on the East Coast, on the Atlantic. Will they be concentrated on the East Coast, and why is that?
The East Coast has a continental shelf. The traditional technologies which are coming across, as we just spoken about, from Europe are fixed bottom technologies, which means that the offshore wind turbine is fixed to the ocean floor, to the seabed. So that's why there's a proliferation of this type of technology down the East Coast. If you go across to the West Coast, there is no continental shelf. It's a sheer drop into the ocean. So the a different type of technology class is going to be required. It's called floating wind, and it's a more expensive technology. But nevertheless, it's an emerging technology which will have its day.
Alan Loudon is Director of Strategic Development at the National Offshore Wind Institute at Bristol Community College in Fall River, Massachusetts. Alan, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
It is without a doubt the worst-performing electrical grid in the United States. Widespread rolling blackouts are everyday events. So are voltage fluctuations that are damaging appliances. I'm talking about Puerto Rico's power grid. Things have gotten so bad that officials recently declared a state of emergency. The crisis has only gotten worse since the private company Luma Energy took over last summer. Residents who blame Luma for recent power failures are calling for demonstrations tomorrow, demanding an end to Luma's contract. Cecilio Ortiz-Garcia will be watching the protest closely. He teaches at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. Puerto Ricans taking to the streets tomorrow over this, I mean, suggests it's really bad, Cecilio. Describe the power failures they are dealing with on a daily basis.
Well, Luma is now the privatizing company taking care of the grid, and they have now taken outages, they say, to be able to deal with the amount of work that they have to do on a decrepit grid that they've taken over. However, it shows in people's inability to access energy at times of the day when it's really inconvenient, and the fact that those outages are not necessarily being announced. They're simply happening for 4 to 6 hours.
The power grid and voltage in Puerto Rico are now so erratic that surges are destroying some people's electrical appliances. I've seen protesters bringing their destroyed washing machines to the offices of Luma Energy. Have you seen this?
I have seen the footage. And to tell you the truth, it's becoming apparent that what we saw in the summer of 2019, when there was a convergence of ire and despair in the streets of Puerto Rico that ended up in the outing of the governor, energy is now becoming a political mobilizer. And what we expect to see tomorrow is more of those types of demonstrations that go beyond just the protest. And Puerto Rico is quickly becoming an example of how critical infrastructure disarray and governance problems can bring about political mobilization, very much as well as, for example, the status question used to be in the past in Puerto Rico.
I mean, the status of statehood or independence.
Yes.
That question. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, demonstrators are so angry, they're calling for Luma Energy's contract to be canceled, full stop. What do they think is a better way to rebuild this broken electrical system?
Some of the groups that are at the front of tomorrow's mobilization have developed alternative plans for the reconstruction of the grid, for the recovery of a lot of these decrepit units of the electric system, and they are actually aligning much, much better with current legislation that asks for Puerto Rico to be 100% renewable by 2050, and current legislation that puts Puerto Rico at the forefront of climate change action in the island.
Well, it seems the solutions so far have been theoretical. For years, Puerto Rico has had a series of outside private contractors, many from the U.S. They step in to run PREPA, the Puerto Rican utility. Many of those contracts, for various reasons, have been so controversial. Luma Energy now has a 15-year contract. Is it also doomed to failure without accountability?
You know, as they say, what starts crooked usually ends crooked. In terms of our energy governance, I am afraid that we are doomed to a much longer recovery and reconstruction than we thought because of the decay of our energy policy institutions and their incapacity to bring about transparency and accountability in their processes.
Cecilio Ortiz-Garcia studies energy policy and governance. He teaches at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley, and taught for many years at the University of Puerto Rico, Mayagüez. Cecilio, good to speak with you again. Thank you for your time.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to The World. China has been flexing its military muscle in the face of Taiwan. Chinese President Xi Jinping says the island will be brought under Beijing's control and that China will use military force if necessary.
This is not surprising. It would be more surprising if we had Xi Jinping saying that he's not going to use force.
What China is thinking when it comes to Taiwan, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A small town in Norway came under attack on Wednesday. One man, armed with a bow and arrows, killed five people. It was the worst mass killing in Norway since a far-right extremist murdered 77 people in 2011. The Norwegian Security Service now says yesterday's attack appears to be an act of terrorism. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry is on the line. What do we know so far about what happened, Orla?
Police say they got word of an attack in the town of Kongsberg, which is about 41 miles southwest of Oslo, after 6 o'clock yesterday evening. The attacker first targeted people in a local supermarket in the town, and then he moved into a residential area. As you say, he had a bow and arrows, but police are also saying today that he had other weapons with him. So the victims appear to have been randomly chosen. They're all aged between 50 and 70. Four women and one man were killed. Three others have been treated in hospital today. But this town of Kongsberg, it is, as you say, it's a small town. Everyone today is describing it as a really calm, really quiet place. And one reporter there, Thea Erdgarden with TV2, the Norwegian TV station, she said to me this afternoon that everyone that she's spoken to today either knows someone who saw what happened or someone who was hurt in the attack.
The people here are just in shock. They're sad, devastated, and there's been people coming out to the street, putting down flowers, lighting candles. We've talked to a lot of people who've seen something or know someone who was involved.
The attacker is now in police custody. What do we know about him?
He's 37 years old. His parents are Danish and Norwegian. He's a Danish citizen, but he was born in Norway. And the last few years, he's been living in this town of Kongsberg. Police said today he has several previous convictions for burglary and for drug possession. But also last year, police said he was given a 6-month restraining order after threatening to kill a family member. So he was known to police, but the motive for his attack isn't yet known.
He was given a psychiatric evaluation, it was reported. There are also police reports today that they had concerns he had been radicalized a few years ago. Do we know anything more about that?
Yeah, police said they'd received some reports of concern, though not in the last 12 months. And this afternoon, a video has emerged that he posted on YouTube a few years back in which he says, "This is a warning. The time has come." A friend of his said today that he was so worried at the time that he contacted the police. That was back in 2017. So this afternoon, Norwegian media are asking, you know, what did the police know back then and whether there was something more that they could have done. This morning, the chairman of the local mosque in Kongsberg, the Kongsberg Islamic Centre, was also talking on Norwegian television. And he said he remembers the attacker visiting the mosque a few years ago. He converted to Islam a few years ago. And the chairman of the mosque said he remembered him because when he visited, he said he hadn't come to pray, but he wanted to convey a message to the world. But when the chairman was asked this morning by the reporter if he thought this man was radicalised, he said, "No, actually, not at all. I thought he'd received some weird sort of revelation, but it had nothing to do with Islam."
This is, Orla, the worst attack since the one staged by ultra-right winger Anders Breivik in 2011. Is there much talk about that today in Norway?
Yeah, I mean, there have been other lone attacks in Norway in the last 10 years. But as you say, this is certainly the highest death toll of any attack since the Anders Breivik attack in 2011. Talking to people in Norway earlier, they said it's simply so rare for mass killings to happen in Norway that people are sort of naturally referring to the Anders Breivik attack again. But of course, this was a very different circumstance and he was a far-right extremist. Police are saying today, pointing out that there is no change to the threat level in the country. It's still been classified as moderate, although police officers in Kongsberg, you know, your regular police officer there, they don't normally carry weapons, and today they're all carrying weapons. And the police force said, look, this is a contingency measure, but that the terrorist threat level has not been raised in the country.
And tonight, the attacker remains in police custody.
Yeah, he admitted to the attacks this morning. His lawyers say he's cooperating with the police. He's set to appear in court tomorrow morning. As you say, they want a psychiatric evaluation to determine whether he's fit to stand trial. And he is reported to have had a history with the psychiatric services in Norway. Interestingly, by the way, Marco, the new Labour Prime Minister started in office today, took over office, and not an auspicious start, I guess. But he was speaking in a news conference this afternoon and he said the attack highlights the shortcomings in Norway's psychiatric services and Norway's psychiatric care. And he pointed out that 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 people who are referred for treatment are being turned down. And this is something that needs to change.
Wow, that's interesting. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
People in Taiwan woke up this morning to news of a deadly fire in the southern city of Kaohsiung. The fire broke out in the middle of the night in the abandoned bottom floors of an old 13-story building. People living in the apartments above were trapped. The flames did not reach them, but a torrent of acrid black smoke was engulfing the upper floors. A bystander shot this video as victims on stretchers were being ferried to ambulances. Taiwanese TV carried rolling coverage. Late-night viewers watched awful scenes of firefighters blasting water through broken windows, while rescue crews on cherry pickers extracted apartment residents from upper-story windows. By dawn, the fire was out. This afternoon, freshly produced news reports scored with music were playing across Taiwanese TV and social media, showing the flames, first responders, and dramatic rescues, and documenting the toll. Nearly 50 people, many of them elderly, died in last night's fire in Kaohsiung. More than 40 others were hospitalized. The cause of the fire is under investigation. Taiwan has been making headlines recently for another reason. It's a flashpoint in the tense relationship between China and the United States. Pentagon officials are expressing concern about Chinese warplanes buzzing by Taiwan in a provocative show of force. Americans and Taiwanese worry that China could invade the island within a few years. But what is the Chinese Communist Party thinking? The World's Patrick Nguyen has that side of the story.
It was recently revealed that small numbers of elite American troops have secretly operated on Taiwanese soil for the last year. Or from Beijing's perspective, Chinese soil. Taiwan just happens to be occupied by an independent democratic government allied with the U.S. But Chinese leader Xi Jinping said last week, this is only temporary. She says the task of unifying the motherland will be fulfilled. U.S. officials warn that armed invasion could be close at hand. They point to Chinese jets buzzing near Taiwan, or Chinese state media saying Taiwan's government is an evil force that must be crushed. Former National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster recently said he thinks China may invade as soon as 2022, after the Beijing Olympics.
I think we are at a point of maximum danger, and that danger will actually, you know, at this, we're on our way up.
That's pretty scary, right? Well, many scholars who study the Chinese Communist Party closely do not think war is imminent. Here's Nicholas Koo from the University of Otago in New Zealand.
So when you actually look at Chinese behavior under a microscope, you can actually separate the heated rhetoric that one hears in the public domain versus what is actually the government's policy.
Make no mistake, Professor Koo says, China under Xi is getting more aggressive with Taiwan. Beijing hates that the island does function as an independent country, as it has since 1949, when communists won control of the mainland and Chinese anti-communists fled to the island, which is only 100 miles off the coast. China's Communist Party has always said it would come for Taiwan someday. And when Xi Jinping says he may use force to take over the island, he means it. But Nicholas Koo says that's to be expected.
This is not surprising. It would be more surprising if we had Xi Jinping saying that he's not going to use force.
He says great powers don't tend to say things like, hey, this disputed territory, we would never use our military to defend it. And moreover, Chinese officials honestly believe they are being bullied, he says. After all, they're the ones who have enemy troops stationed near their coast, advising Taiwan's military, which is armed with high-tech American weaponry. And also, what about the U.S. warships that frequently pass through the waters between China and Taiwan? Professor Koo says Beijing is thinking, hold on, isn't that provocative too? Are we supposed to just take it?
They would expect the United States to show them the proper respect that is accorded China as a historically important great power in the system.
China is more powerful than ever, and the Communist Party believes it has every right to say, yeah, we could take over Taiwan if we wanted to. But listen more closely to what Xi Jinping is saying. In that same speech, Xi said unifying with Taiwan peacefully is best for China's people and their compatriots in Taiwan. Nicholas Koo says Beijing isn't that bloodthirsty for a Taiwan siege. Party officials know that would be militarily difficult a diplomatic nightmare, and it would risk war with the U.S. So it's more of a last resort.
They really would like a unification that occurs in a peaceful manner. And in fact, that's probably their number one wish.
How and when they plan to realize that wish is not clear. Most Taiwanese people are repulsed by the idea of living under Chinese rule. But that is the goal, Ku says. As for sounding the bells of war, that may be good for U.S. defense budgets, but the professor says, don't bet on an all-out invasion anytime soon. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
There are two types of people in this world, those who slog through a book, no matter how bad or boring it is, and those who just give up. I am a slogger, but as the world's Sarah Birnbaum reports, maybe it's time to change my ways.
If you're like Marco, then English novelist Mark Billingham has some advice for you. At the Cheltenham Literary Festival over the weekend, he said if you're 20 pages into a book and it's still boring, you should not only stop reading, you should chuck it across the room, angrily. Billingham, who wrote the Tom Thorne crime series, says life's too short. In the literary world, them's fighting words. So it's not surprising that readers from England to Scotland to New Zealand have been weighing in on local radio stations.
I actually try and finish every single book I read, no matter what.
People just don't have the time to stick with something that they haven't got a connection with.
Something like Henry James or George Eliot, it takes a wee while to get into it.
Personally, I find the advice intriguing, and I am going to take Mark Billingham up on it. Sorry, Carl Ove Nosgard, my struggle book one. So that was on an e-reader, not very satisfying. But never fear, I have a bookshelf, so I'm going to make my way to it. I found the book that I've been wanting to toss for years. Capital by Thomas Piketty. Oh, sorry, pup. She's fine. So, anyway, I would highly recommend this activity. Just make sure your loved ones are out of harm's way. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
After COVID, tuberculosis is the deadliest infectious disease on the planet. It kills about 1.5 million people worldwide each year. Tuberculosis is preventable if diagnosed properly and treated, but COVID-19 is hampering that. For the first time in more than a decade, deaths worldwide from tuberculosis are on the rise. Joining me now is Salman Keshavji, a professor in global health at Harvard Medical School. So with tuberculosis deaths up, I mean, at the same time, the World Health Organization reports a sharp decrease in the number of people being diagnosed with tuberculosis during COVID. Explain what's going on.
Well, tuberculosis, like COVID, is another airborne disease. So it's passed in the air in families, communities, and places where people work. And of course, interestingly, like COVID, only about 40 to 50% of people have symptoms. So if you're not going around and screening people for TB, or if somebody has TB, you're not screening their relatives to see if they have the disease or they've been exposed to it, then you basically end up with more undiagnosed TB in the community. And so what WHO has shown, World Health Organization has shown, is that the amount of TB that's being found is much less than what's expected. So normally, there's about 7 million cases a year that are found out of the 10 million that they know are out there, you know, based on surveys. And this year, it's dropped to 5.8 million people. So less people with the disease are being found, which means less people get put on treatment. More transmission of the disease happens in communities. And in the end, more people die.
TB is a global problem, as I said. Where do most of these infections take place?
So it's outside of countries that, you know, high-income countries. So it's outside of Western Europe and the United States and Canada and Australia and New Zealand. So it's really, you know, concentrated in parts of Africa, Asia, South America, and communities that are poor.
If TB is preventable, why does it affect so many people?
You know, if you think about this, if you have this airborne disease like we're facing with COVID today, you have to be able to have some sort of way to screen people in the community. in North America and Europe, that started early in the 20th century. There would be mobile x-ray vans that would be set up in communities to screen people for TB. And that hasn't been the case in a lot of impoverished settings because of resource issues and because of advice that they've received not to do that because it's too expensive. And so if you can't find people, then you can't get them on treatment. And if you don't get them on treatment, they continue spreading the disease in the community.
So if people infected with TB are not coming forward for a diagnosis for whatever reasons, is it possible the numbers could be way higher in the COVID era?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, the estimate, of course, is that there's more, just over 10 million new cases every year, of which the WHO is now saying only 5.8 million are found. So they're estimating there's just over 4 million cases missing. But in actual fact, it could be much more. I'll tell you something interesting. Where we've gone in with x-rays into communities to look for TB, you often find somewhere between 2 and 10 times the estimated rate. So if you look for it, you find it.
Salman, do we know why people are not getting diagnosed for TB?
Well, so the WHO basically says that the reason right now is that a lot of resources have been put to COVID. So people that used to work in the TB services are focusing on COVID. There's been lockdowns. People are scared, you know, to go to hospitals and other facilities to seek care. And so people aren't coming forward if they think they have the symptoms of TB, which interestingly are very similar to COVID. So they're, you know, a cough, weight loss, things like that. So they're not coming forward. So the fact that we're not able to find TB patients is kind of a, you know, like a warning that we have major problems with the ability of our health systems to reach into communities and diagnose and treat people. Because 10 million people a year get TB. By 2040, there's going to be 750 million people estimated with diabetes. That's a disease that needs to be diagnosed and treated in the community. So when you start to think about it, this is a harbinger of something really bad unless we change the way we are screening and delivering care in communities.
Salman Keshavji is a global health professor at Harvard Medical School, speaking with us about the rise in tuberculosis deaths worldwide during the pandemic. Salman, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
When top Pentagon officials retire or resign, they often do so quietly. Not Nicolas Chalon. He's sounding the alarm. He was a Pentagon software chief, and when it comes to China, he says they are miles ahead when it comes to artificial intelligence, AI. Chalon called the cybersecurity at some Pentagon departments kindergarten level and said he spent most of his time fixing basic cloud things and laptops. Nicolas Chalon joins me now. Can you tell me about the moment you decided you had to leave the Pentagon? Why did you quit?
I was seeing the Pentagon leadership talk the talk, but they were not willing to walk the walk. And so at some point, it was really getting to the point where I was not able to impact change. And we had to wake up because we were running out of time. And the sense of urgency was just not there. At worst, you know, we see Pentagon reports say we have another 10 years to figure it out when it is just plain not true. And so I thought if I come out and I have the chance to keep the fight from the outside, and that will have a bigger impact.
So if the Pentagon says we've got 10 years to figure out AI and cyber, how much time do you give it?
We are out of time. The commercial side of the U.S. is leading, no doubt, but we do not have access to it at scale in DoD. We have pockets of it. That's the difference with China, of course. They have access to the entirety of their commercial talent. And, you know, when it comes to AI, the faster you can train and the more data you get and the faster you move, the more advanced it gets. And so it's exponential. And at some point, there is a point of no return where you just can't catch up.
So are you saying secrecy is standing in the way of the U.S. of collaborating with the private sector?
100%. You know, not only we overclassify information, I find sometimes that I already knew things from the commercial side on the public domain that ended up being classified for the wrong reasons. But also, it also prevents us from reaching out to these companies and startups. And we lose all this great intellectual property and talent just because we can't tell them what's going on. And I believe if they were to see it, they would proactively want to participate and join the fight.
So your view, Nicolas, is that the U.S. will remain hopelessly behind China on AI unless Washington takes immediate action. Explain how advanced AI from China could be used against the U.S. and the rest of the world.
Well, AI is going to be what's going to make it or break it in terms of the next fights. When it comes to the war fighting side, you see recently DARPA did a an event where we had, AI on the jet, flying the jet, and then you have the best U.S. pilots flying the F-16 jets, and every single time AI won.
So you've criticized the Pentagon and Silicon Valley for what you see as their preoccupation with the possible ethical problems with AI and how these debates are holding the U.S. back from catching up with China. But if the U.S. were to look past those dilemmas and just start building more sophisticated AI, isn't that a recipe for an out-of-control AI arms race that could get really dangerous?
Yes, but it would be even more dangerous if we don't do it. The fact is, you don't want to be the one without the deterrence. When China has no limitation in applying AI into their weapons, that's foolish to be the one proactively limiting ourselves when we know the adversary has no care for it. That's just completely foolish. We need to be smart enough to be proactive. We also need to be cautious and care about our values. Just like nuclear power, we hope we're not going to use it, but you better be able to do it if you have to.
So earlier this year, a group of researchers at the Max Planck Institute concluded that there is no algorithm that could be written to control super intelligent AI, like the HAL 9000 computer, the computer in 2001, A Space Odyssey. What if these weapons turn on us?
Yeah, I mean, that's why ethics matter. And you want to make sure, particularly when it comes to weapon system, that they only give you insight. They don't actually make decisions. Take a step back and you look at what's going on in Afghanistan and the recent incident where we bombed the wrong target. I would argue that better AI could have prevented this, right? We could have detected through satellite imagery and automation and broader scale automation that, kids were in the car.
Congress just passed a $768 billion defense spending bill. Did you see enough money in the bill going towards the problems you're most worried about?
Well, honestly, I think we don't really have a money problem. We have a waste of money problem. We see silos and egos getting in the way and bureaucracy getting in the way, lack of agility. There is no agile training until, we created it. So if we don't have the training and we don't invest in our people and empower our war fighter, we need to get out of the way. We need to invest in our people, and that's going to be the answer.
Nicholas, having seen the insides of the Pentagon and U.S. cyber policy, what keeps you up at night?
Well, way too much keeps me up at night, and that's kind of why it was becoming unhealthy for me to stay inside. When you keep talking about the same problem for 3 years, you see some progress, but not enough, and your kids have no fighting chance to win the war 10 to 15 years from now. And I think we need to hold people accountable, and we need to make sure people stop using excuses and classification levels to hide mistakes being made and tremendous waste of taxpayer money across the silos we talked about when we see Army refusing to use the Air Force cloud and software capabilities and then publicly saying the reason is to have a healthy competition between Air Force and the Army when they fail to realize the only competitor we have is China and Russia. That's just short-sighted, and it just keeps happening. That's not something that China is doing because they know how to push things top to bottom.
Nicholas Chalon was the Pentagon software chief for the Air Force and Space Force. He resigned earlier this month. Nicholas, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Before we leave you today, a moment to remember legendary Irish musician Paddy Maloney. Paddy Maloney, master of the Illion pipes, slide whistle, and penny whistle, and co-founder of the Chieftains. Stories were the backbone of the music Paddy composed and performed. When I spoke with him in 2010, he recounted a story for me. When many Irish arrived in the U.S. in the mid-19th century, Maloney explained, the Mexican-American War was being fought, and Irish immigrants were told to grab a gun and go kill the Mexicans. But the Irish didn't like that assignment.
So they they rebelled about it, and so a big bunch of them got together and formed a battalion called the San Patricio, and they fought on the side of the Mexicans. And it's a kind of a story that wasn't told. It's not in the history books.
That story led Maloney and the Chieftains to record a whole album about the San Patricio, or St. Patrick, Battalion.
Now we come from Cork and Kerry, that emerald world has passed. My Mary would be pleased to know I'm a praying man at last.
In Ireland, Paddy Maloney's death has been headline news.
President Michael D. Higgins has led tributes to the musician Paddy Maloney, who has died at the age of 83.
That's from RTE Television in Ireland. We leave you today with a sublime moment captured by a Spanish documentary team some years ago. Paddy Maloney on his penny whistle, outside, blue skies, playing to a field of grass and birds. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.